about WikiLeaks?
I know nothing about WikiLeaks. It's not my thing.
WikiLeaks! I love WikiLeaks.
Looks like Bernie got a little bit of a bad deal based on WikiLeaks, right?
They want to distract us from WikiLeaks. It's been amazing what's coming out on WikiLeaks.
And all you have to do is take a look at WikiLeaks and just see what they said about Bernie Sanders.
Even Chelsea Clinton, the WikiLeaks email show, expressed serious concerns about conflicts of interest at the Clinton Foundation and the State Department.
I know there is something having to do with Julian Assange. I've been seeing what's happened with Assange, and that will be a determination, I would imagine, mostly by the Attorney General, who's doing an excellent job. So he'll be making a determination. I know nothing really about him. It's not my deal in life.
I finally met my new celly, Schulte wrote in a prison diary. He's in for bankruptcy. He's a nice guy who's on medication for a mental illness. Schulte hated confinement. If you try to shower without purchasing shower shoes, then you will almost certainly contract MRSA or some other skin-eating staph bacteria. But he appears to have found ways to keep his temper under control, having observed that it was necessary to exercise basic diplomacy, given that some members of his new cohort were convicted murderers. He was fascinated by the innovative ways that inmates gamed prison regulations, noticing that many people claimed to be Muslim or Jewish because doing so entitled them to supposedly better food. And he made some friends on the floor where he was housed, including Omar Amanat, a Wharton-educated financier who was facing charges related to conspiracy to commit securities fraud, as well as Carlos Luna, a seasoned drug trafficker. Schulte reflected, "I've lost my job, health insurance, friends, my reputation, and an entire year of my life. And this is only the beginning." But he vowed to go down swinging and bring this justice system crumbling to its knees. First, he would need a phone. At the prison, he could make calls on payphones, but they were monitored and did not offer internet access. Luckily, black market smartphones were easy to come by. Luna had a sideline in smuggling them into the facility. According to a former inmate who did time at the MCC alongside Schulte, the going rate for contraband smartphones were several thousand dollars. Schulte figured out a way to hotwire a light switch in his cell so that it worked as a cell phone charger. The person who knew Schulte during this period praised his innovation, saying that after that, all MCC phones were charged that way. Schulte and Amanat, who had also obtained a phone, would meet in the cell of a guy named Chino, and Luna would serve as lookout while the others used their clandestine devices. On an encrypted Samsung phone, Schulte created an anonymous Facebook page called John Galt's Legal Defense Fund and posed some of his prison writings. He set up a Twitter account, @FreeJasonBourne, and in a drafts folder, he saved a tweet that said, "The @DepartmentofJustice arrested the wrong man for Vault 7. I personally know exactly what happened, as do many others. Why are they covering it up?" Schulte also contacted Shane Harris, a journalist at the Washington Post. In messages to Harris, Schulte pretended to be other people, a cousin or one of his three brothers, and promised to share explosive information. In this sock puppet guise, he sent Harris what the government alleges was classified information about his case. Astonishingly, it appears that Schulte may have even made contact with WikiLeaks during this period. In a Twitter post on June 19, 2018, WikiLeaks released 7 installments of Schulte's prison writings, billing them as an account in which the alleged CIA Vault 7 whistleblower would finally speak out in his own words. Schulte seemed to have written these essays, which combined diaristic accounts of prison life with a broader critique of the criminal justice system as a sort of letter from a Birmingham jail. He titled them Presumption of Innocence. Perhaps WikiLeaks simply stumbled on the Facebook page where these essays appeared, or perhaps it was in touch with Schulte. If indeed Schulte managed to contact WikiLeaks from prison, he was adopting a curious strategy. It would be pathologically self-sabotaging to counter allegations that he had shared a set of documents with WikiLeaks by sharing another set of documents with WikiLeaks. In one of these jailhouse meditations, Schulte wrote that, in prison, it is prudent not to discuss your case with anyone, because people are vultures and would do anything to help their own situation, including barter your information for a better deal. Any scenario that encourages disloyalty, dissension, and snitching is a powerful psychological tool, he warned. But Schulte may not have appreciated quite how true this was, because at a certain point, his trusty lookout, Carlos Luna, informed prison authorities that Schulte had a cell phone. When this news reached the FBI, officials panicked. If Schulte could surreptitiously make calls and access the internet, there was a danger that he was continuing to leak. There was a great deal of urgency to find the phone, one bureau official later acknowledged. One day, in October 2018, no fewer than 50 agents descended on the Metropolitan Correctional Center, accompanied by a cell phone sniffing dog. After they recovered the device, investigators found that it was encrypted, but also that Schulte, true to form, had written the password down in one of his notebooks. He was then placed in solitary confinement. The criminal trial of Joshua Schulte, which commenced on February 4, 2020, at the federal courthouse in Manhattan, was unlike any other in U.S. history. A decision had been made to postpone the child pornography indictment and the Virginia sexual assault charge. Both cases could be pursued at a later date. For now, the government focused on Vault 7, issuing 10 charges, ranging from lying to the FBI to illegal transmission of classified information. It had taken federal prosecutors 3 years to assemble the evidence that they would present in court, in part because of the official secrecy involved, and in part because they intended to summon more than a dozen CIA officers to testify under oath about Schulte's tenure at the OSB. This was a delicate and highly unusual strategy. To speak in public about what happens on the job is to violate one of the signature prohibitions of an agency career. It was an indication of how seriously CIA officials took Schulte's alleged offenses, and they were prepared to forego this traditional reticence for the purposes of a trial. As the proceedings got underway, the theater of secrecy was conspicuous. Most of the CIA witnesses would appear using pseudonyms, or would be identified only by their first names. Agency witnesses further avoided scrutiny by using a special elevator during their testimony, and the courtroom was closed to the public. These precautions seemed somewhat excessive. After all, the witnesses were not covert operatives with assumed names or highly placed U.S. assets in treacherous circumstances abroad. They were, by and large, just like Josh Schulte, easy pass warriors who lived in the D.C. suburbs and commuted to an office park. It was a stretch to suggest that the very fact of their employment at the CIA amounted to a grand state secret. One member of Schulte's defense team was Sabrina Shroff, a feisty and tenacious federal public defender who grew up in Islamabad. "You're going to have to take this as a given," I don't dwell on Mr. Schulte's shortcomings, she said when asked about his volatility. He's my client. Schroff is diminutive and intense and quick to chuckle at the Kafkaesque predicaments of this case. But she was also severely constrained in what she could say. We don't have the ability to cross-examine the classification authority, she pointed out. When the government designates something secret, she cannot appeal that decision. Before the trial began, Schroff already possessed a top-secret security clearance. She had needed one to defend other clients facing national security charges. But in order to represent Schulte, she had to be read in to even higher levels of compartmentalized secrecy. All the classified material she would need to consult could be accessed only in a room on the 9th floor of the courthouse, a sensitive compartmented information facility, or SCIF, designed to house classified information. The defense team felt hamstrung in its efforts to represent its client. Normally, defense attorneys receive the names of prosecution witnesses in advance and can research their backgrounds while preparing for cross-examination. When Schroff and her fellow attorneys got the names, however, they were prohibited from performing any Google searches that might in any way link these individuals to the CIA. Because some witnesses had common names and Schroff and her team could not add the letter CIA to their search terms, it was occasionally impossible to gather any information. These are shadows to us, one of Schroff's partners, Edward Zoss, protested to the judge in the case, Paul Crotty. We are completely blind. Every day of the trial, a small posse of blonde women in professional garb arrived and sat together, observing. They kept to themselves and didn't speak to anyone else, but it was generally understood that they were the lawyers or officials from the CIA. Their facial expressions uniformly unrevealing, they came and went in lockstep, like Stepford Wives, but they radiated muted power. The parade of witnesses from the CIA offered a rare glimpse of the office dynamics in a top-secret unit. It was sobering. The descriptions of Schulte's workplace called to mind not the steely competence of the Bourne identity, but rather the tiresome hijinks and petty scheming of office space. This was the paradox of the proceedings. There was no way for the CIA to exact retribution against Schulte without, in the process, revealing a great deal of unflattering information about itself. Jurors would be told the story of an elite national security division that had become consumed by juvenile name-calling and recrimination. Senior CIA officials would have to submit to cross-examination about the frequency and the severity of Nerf gun fights or about the lax security that had made the breach possible. Schulte's former colleagues portrayed him as thin-skinned and volcanically malicious, and this proved to be the core of the government's case. He's not some kind of whistleblower, one of the prosecutors, David Denton, told the jury. He did it out of spite. He did it because he was angry and disgruntled at work. But Schroff's defense strategy rested on a sly pivot. She readily conceded that Schulte was an asshole. He antagonized his colleagues, she said. He antagonized management. He really was a difficult employee. Nevertheless, she added, being a difficult employee does not make you a criminal. Schroff further suggested that the story of Vault 7 was a parable not about the rash decision of one traitor, but about the systemic ineptitude of the CIA. The agency didn't even realize that it had been robbed, she pointed out, until WikiLeaks began posting the disclosures. For God's sake, Schroff said in court, they went a whole year without knowing that their super secure system had been hacked. Then the agency embarked on a witch hunt, she continued, and quickly settled on an easy target, Schulte. Within this narrative, the string of prosecution witnesses recounting horror stories about Schulte's workplace behavior almost seemed to play in Schroff's favor. Her client was a scapegoat, she insisted. The guy nobody liked. The government had amassed a powerful case indicating that Schulte was the leaker. It was abundantly clear that he had motivations for taking revenge on the CIA. The professional biography that emerged at trial was so damning that a decision to leak terabytes of classified data seemed almost logical. The final explosion of a man whose nickname was literally the nuclear option. Schulte's incriminating Google searches further deepened his appearance of guilt, and on the sixth day of the trial, prosecutors laid out what they regarded as a coup de grace, the digital equivalent of fingerprints at a crime scene. Even after Schulte was stripped of his administrative privileges, he had secretly retained the ability to access the OSB network through a back door by using a special key that he had set up. The password was KingJosh3000. The government contended that on April 20th, 2016, Schulte had used his digital key to enter the system. The files were backed up every day, and while he was logged on, Schulte accessed one particular backup, not from that day, but from 6 weeks earlier on March 3rd. The OSB files released by WikiLeaks were identical to the backup from March 3rd, 2016. As Denton told the jurors, it was the exact backup, the exact secrets that were put out by WikiLeaks. But all this was quite a complex fact pattern to present to a jury, involving virtual machines and administrative privileges and backups and logs. Much of the expert testimony presented by the prosecutors was extremely technical. Schroff, meanwhile, insisted that Schulte hadn't stolen the data. Perhaps someone else in the office or at the agency had done it. The real outrage was that a crucial CIA computer network, Devlin, had been unprotected. Hundreds of people had access to Devlin, including not just CIA employees, but contractors. The CIA's hackers appear to have disregarded even the kinds of elementary information security protocols that any civilian worker can recite from mandatory corporate training. Coders exchanged passwords with one another and sometimes shared sensitive details on post-it notes. They used passwords that were laughably weak, including 123ABCDEF. A classified damage assessment conducted by the CIA after the Vault 7 exposure concluded that security procedures had indeed been woefully lax and that the agency's hackers prioritized building cyber weapons at the expense of securing their own systems. Nevertheless, the prosecutors presented striking circumstantial evidence indicating that Schulte had probably transmitted the material to WikiLeaks. On April 24th, he downloaded Tails, an operating system that WikiLeaks recommends for submitting data to the organization. On April 30th, he stayed up all night, frequently checking his computer, and at 3:21 a.m., he consulted a webpage that offered guidance on how to make sure that a terabyte of data had been transferred correctly. That evening, he also searched for tips on how to wipe a device of its contents. What the government could not prove was any direct communication between Schulte and WikiLeaks. Hovering over the proceedings was a dark question. How much harm had been caused by the leak? When Schroff cross-examined Sean Roche, the CIA official who described Vault 7 as a digital Pearl Harbor, she asked, "How many people died in Pearl Harbor?" "More than 3,000," Roche replied. How many people died as a result of Vault 7? She asked. I don't have an answer to that, Roche said. In fact, none, correct? Shroff said. Roche was probably being hyperbolic, but this may have been an instance in which the secrecy surrounding the case put the government at a disadvantage. After China uncovered a network of U.S. intelligence assets operating inside its borders in 2010, authorities in Beijing systematically rounded up a dozen people who had secretly been working for the CIA and murdered them, crippling American espionage efforts in the country for years to come. That deadly purge did not become public knowledge until it was reported in the press in 2017. Given that the OSB hacks often required human assistance to install, it seems possible that foreign powers penetrated by such exploits could have leveraged the leak to identify American assets and seek retribution in a manner similar to what occurred in China. If any countries did, or if they do so in the future, that is information that the CIA would be unlikely to publicize. One morning in January 2020, the jurors in the Schulte case entered the courtroom to discover a giant bottle of Purell on a table. The attorneys had been so consumed by the case that they had hardly noticed the pandemic barreling toward them. Meanwhile, one of the jurors ended up being removed from the case because, much like Schulte himself, she couldn't stay off the internet. The normal prohibition on jurors reading press coverage was particularly acute in this instance because if the jury knew that Schulte had also been charged with sexual assault and possession of child pornography, it could prejudice the verdict. The juror seemed only too happy to be cut loose, telling the Post, "Sitting in that chair for 5 weeks was like punishment for my ass." After Schroff delivered an emphatic closing argument in the case, she visited the bathroom, where she crossed paths with one of the Stepford wives. Up to this point, none of these CIA women had uttered a word to her. "Nice job," the woman said crisply and walked out. As the jurors began deliberations, they sent out a series of notes with questions that seemed to indicate some genuine confusion about the technical aspects of the government's case. On March 9th, they convicted Schulte of two lesser charges, contempt of court and lying to the FBI, but hung on the 8 more serious counts, including those accusing him of transmitting national security secrets to WikiLeaks. Judge Crotty declared a mistrial. The prosecution had clearly blundered by getting so mired in technical minutiae, and Schroff had ably defended her client. But it was also tempting to wonder whether in the years since WikiLeaks was established in 2006, public attitudes toward both the intelligence community and the act of leaking itself might have shifted. Endless revelations concerning warrantless wiretapping, the use of torture, and extrajudicial killing have done little to enhance the prestige or the moral standing of America's defense and intelligence establishment. And many people consider Snowden and Manning, along with Julian Assange, the founder of WikiLeaks, to be heroes. Of course, in Schulte's case, there did not appear to be any moral imperative driving the leak. If he did it, he wasn't blowing the whistle, but seeking payback. And he continued to deny that he did it. Edward Lee Howard, the disgruntled CIA officer who handed secrets to the Soviets, went to his death denying that he had done so. The person who served time with Schulte in the MCC said, "What Josh told me is that he thinks a mole set him up." The mistrial was a devastating turn for the government, but Schulte's father, who came from Texas with Deanna to attend the proceedings and staunchly believed in his innocence, was disappointed. Roger Schulte, who didn't know what a hung jury was, asked Schroff, You mean he wasn't acquitted? The child pornography and sexual assault cases have still not been resolved. When Schulte's parents were asked about those charges, they said that though they believe in Josh's innocence, they haven't spoken to him about the particulars of either case or examined the available evidence themselves, so they were not in a position to offer any preview of his defense. But the U.S. government, rather than push forward with these other cases, which might have resulted in an easier conviction, instead announced that it would put Schulte on trial again for Vault 7. Schulte currently resides at the Metropolitan Detention Center in Brooklyn, where he has been preparing for his new trial. Most observers of the case agree that Schulte is fortunate to have a lawyer like Schroff, but he doesn't necessarily share this view. After the government announced that it would retry him, he dismissed her and opted to represent himself. Schroff has stayed on, however, as standby counsel. "I've been with Mr. Schulte for 5 years," she said. "We went through a pandemic together. We went through a trial together. Most marriages don't survive this kind of trauma." For security reasons, they can't take garbage out of the room, so trash accumulates among the boxes of highly classified documents. The lawyers used to bring Schulte snacks before the marshals banned food in the skiff. "He's such a persnickety eater," Schroff said with affectionate exasperation. "If I go to Chipotle, it has to be white rice and only black beans." In prison, Schulte has grown an impressive beard. To nobody's surprise, Schulte has tangled with his prison guards and in repeated filings to the new judge in his case, Jesse M. Furman, he has singled out individual guards and suggested that they should be facing criminal charges. Schulte has filed more than 60 official challenges to the conditions of his confinement. In prolix memos, many of them handwritten, he has condemned the Justice Department, the CIA, the FBI, and the Bureau of Prisons. He refers to his cell as a torture cage and maintains that his living conditions are below that of impoverished persons living in third world countries. One of his complaints is that the guards do not give him adequate bathroom breaks during the hours he spends preparing his case in the prison law library. And so, lately, Schulte has taken to urinating in the law library. He has also converted to Islam. When this was mentioned to Kavi Patel, he bursts out laughing. "He's manipulative," Patel said. "I don't know how else to say it." One might question whether this conversion is simply a ploy to get better food, but many people discover faith behind bars, and Schulte recently observed a month of daytime fasting during Ramadan. The new trial began on June 13th. The government seemed unlikely to present quite as much evidence of Schulte's antisocial behavior this time. It was expected to abbreviate the technical evidence too. The proceedings, however, remained blanketed in secrecy. Matthew Russell Lee, an independent journalist who covered the first trial, recently filed an objection to the government's motion to seal the courtroom during testimony from CIA officers, but the condition applied again. Schulte, meanwhile, sought to call no fewer than 48 current or former CIA employees as witnesses. One of the people he tried to summon is Amal. At a recent hearing, Schulte suggested that if the evidence he requests is too sensitive to transport to the skiff, perhaps they should take me to the CIA. Judge Furman responded flatly, "You are not going to the CIA." We live in an era that has been profoundly warped by the headstrong impulses of men who are technically sophisticated but emotionally immature. From the whoopee cushion antics of Elon Musk to the Panglossian implacability of Mark Zuckerberg, a particular personality profile dominates these times: the boy emperor. It's often wondered how the CIA could have missed the obvious combustibility of this profile when it hired Schulte and gave him a security clearance. In order to get an agency job, Schulte had to been subjected to a battery of tests. But when his lawyers tried to obtain the psychological profile that the agency had produced on him, the CIA would not turn it over. Perhaps as the agency took up digital spying and sought to bolster its hacking capability, it de-emphasized qualities like emotional stability and turned a blind eye to the sorts of erratic and antisocial tendencies that are widely accepted in Silicon Valley and even embraced as the price of genius. The agency may have blinkered about Schulte's destructive potential because it had concluded that this was simply how coders behave. One has to wonder whether Schulte was more idiot or savant. When you consider the powerful forces arrayed against him and the balance of probabilities that he is guilty, Schulte's decision to represent himself seems reckless. But for the CIA and the Justice Department, he remains a formidable adversary because he is bent on destroying them. He has little to lose, and his head is full of classified information. Lawyers are bound, Schroff said. There are certain things we can't argue, certain arguments we can't make. But if you're pro se, representing yourself, you can make all the motions you want. You can really try your case. The government does not bring a lawsuit every time it identifies somebody who has inappropriately leaked classified information. On the contrary, a decision is often made to settle the matter quietly rather than risk further exposure of secrets in a public trial. Schulte might well attempt to force the disclosure of so many secrets that the authorities will feel compelled to drop the charges against him or to offer an attractive plea deal. There may be some threshold of disclosure beyond which the CIA will not venture. Deanna Schulte said that one reason her son had elected to serve as his own counsel is that he wants to put it all out there. In a June 2nd court filing, Schulte suggested, with a menacing flourish, that if the government goes to trial with the child pornography charges, he plans to make it maximally painful for the CIA. His defense, he promised, will incorporate extensive testimony about agency operations and assets and will potentially require courtroom appearances from 9 covert officers, 17 overt officers, and at least one asset. In a contest between the dictates of official secrecy and the imperatives of justice, odds are that secrecy will win. Schulte knows this, and that may be his greatest advantage. He has said of the Vault 7 case, "I expect a not guilty verdict on all counts, and anything less will be an utter failure." Schroff said of her client, "He's hopeful now." Roger Schulte said the same thing, assuring that Josh has learned a lot about the legal process and that he isn't giving up. "He seems to be holding pretty strong," Roger said. "He's a fighter." Wednesday, July 13th, 2022, for immediate release. Statement of U.S. Attorney Damian Williams on the espionage conviction of ex-CIA programmer Joshua Adam Schulte. Joshua Adam Schulte was a CIA programmer with access to some of the country's most valuable intelligence-gathering cyber tools used to battle terrorist organizations and other malign influences around the globe. When Schulte began to harbor resentment toward the CIA, he covertly collected those tools and provided them to WikiLeaks, making some of our most critical intelligence tools known to the public, and therefore our adversaries. Moreover, Schulte was aware that the collateral damage of his retribution could pose an extraordinary threat to this nation if made public, rendering them essentially useless, having a devastating effect on our intelligence community by providing critical intelligence to those who wish to do us harm. Today, Schulte has been convicted for one of the most brazen and damaging acts of espionage in American history.